The 1940s, our speaker held hearings on a plan for a system of transcontinental highways, what we now know as the interstate highway system. It was our speaker who authored a 1936 bill allowing the blind to operate vending machines in federal buildings. Widely copied by state and local governments around the country, that law has allowed thousands of handicapped Americans to obtain jobs where otherwise they would depend on welfare. Because of the 26th Amendment, people of our age have the right to vote now, and our speaker has been championing the cause of potential voters from 18 to 20 since 1942, when he introduced legislation on that subject. Without the efforts of people like our speaker, we all would be disenfranchised. Our speaker helped draft the Democratic platforms in 1956 and 68, and was a West Virginia delegate to the Democratic National Convention in 48, 52, 56, 64, 68, and 76. So experience he has. It is a profound pleasure to welcome to Washington Lee and to the 1984 mock Democratic Convention, the senior senator from the neighboring state of West Virginia, Senator Jennings Randolph.
Thank you very much, Mike. First of all, I just can't understand why there are so few women at Washington Lee University. Why, I'll not go into the statistics, but I've checked them out. But do you realize, gentlemen, that in this election in November, there will be 8 million women eligible to vote more than men. 8 million, 8 million, 8 million. I repeat, 8 million more women will be eligible to vote in November than men. Franklin Roosevelt knew that on the day he was sworn in, March the 4th, 1933. He nominated a woman to be a member of the cabinet of the United States. Frances Perkins, Secretary of Labor. She served during all the years that that peerless leader was in the White House. Now, very quietly, on the night of March the 19th, 1933, in company with the 6 other members of the House of Representatives who had been elected in 1932, we came to the White House. It was dreary. It was rainy. It was cold. A fire was burning in the grate on the second floor of that White House. By the way, I take this moment. You know, I find so many people that come to Washington, they see the buildings. Well, you know, those buildings are only there because the American people are at work and pay taxes. That's the only reason that they're there. People talk as if, well, this is something that we don't know about, all of these buildings in the nation's capital and throughout America. But I want at the very outset, if I may, to suggest to you that more importantly than what I call strong Republicans or stronger Democrats, that we are working citizens of the United States of America. Very quietly, we sat in a semicircle, the 7 of us. The President of the United States, who had been sworn in on March the 4th By the way, now everyone comes in January. Senate, House, the President. In those days, the President took his oath of office on March the 4th, was sworn in, and then 9 days later, we of the House of Representatives took our oaths of office and began our work in the House of Representatives. Now, let's think for a moment of what the President was saying, not only to us, but through all the years until this moment, he really was speaking to you. He said, "This is no time for small talk. We must do something, and we must do it quickly. We must, within 100 days, not turn America around, but turn America up." That's what he said. One of our colleagues from the Middle West, long gone, he said, "Mr. President, I'm for your projects and your programs, but you're trying to do too much too quickly. The people can't digest it, they can't absorb it, and I'm afraid it will fail." The President neither smiled or frowned. He just, for a moment, seemed to be somewhere else. And then he inched forward. He could not walk, as you know. I'm not just given to phraseology, but Franklin Roosevelt could not walk. But he put America on his feet. That's exactly what he did. And then after the criticism, which was not criticism, he looked at all of us and he said, "But gentlemen, do you realize we must act now? By acting now, we will make mistakes. But if we do not act now, I'm afraid that just a little later, we will not be given even the opportunity to make the mistakes." Do you realize that in the campaign of 1932, there was not only Herbert Hoover asking for re-election under the banner of the Republican Party, and Franklin Roosevelt, the standard bearer of your party and my party. By the way, are there any Democrats here tonight? I just wonder. Yeah, fine. But did you know that there were other parties? Did you know that the Communist Party of the United States had a candidate for president? In 1932, because the country was in a desperate, almost a devastating decline, and people were grasping and questing for something. Now, what I'm saying is that tonight we are in a similar condition in the United States of America. You may not realize it, because then we had 24% unemployment. Today we have perhaps 8% unemployment. We have 100 million more people living in this country than we had 50 years ago. The reason that I'm mentioning this tonight is to say to all of you, by the way, I just believe there's someone that's been a graduate of this institution, Earl Palmer Brown. Earl, are you around tonight? I believe you came up or down from Washington. Yeah. I've known him for so long. You should do what he does. Make money when you're graduated from Washington Lee University. Now, let's see. In 100 days, think of it. 100 days, we passed 15 major measures that brought America back. 12 of those measures have sustained us through the years. They're on the books as you meet here tonight. I'll not go into them, but they're still there. They were not just, you know, for the moment. And that must be the purpose always of any party, that it has some continuity, that it doesn't jump here and there at the fancy or seemingly the demands of some certain group. There has to be the substance, the vision, and the spirit of a party. That's what we have. I hope you'll allow me to tell you, and I want you to believe me, that the first Democratic National Convention that I attended was in 1912. 1912. I sat on the knee of my father, who was a delegate elected from West Virginia. And he, West Virginia, that's right, that's right. He was for what man for president? Woodrow Wilson. That's who he was for. And my grandfather was there, not as a delegate, and he was ardently for Champ Clark of Missouri, the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives. Oh, you may say, Randolph, we don't want to hear about all of that. That's a long time ago. But I say to you tonight, in understanding, that I believe there are times when to do something that is forward-looking, you have to look back and see what has been done by the Democratic Party of the United States of America. Well, of course, in 1908, you showed a wonderful judgment. You, in your convention here at Washington and Lee University, you gave the nomination to William Jennings Bryan. You did what you should have done, because William Jennings Bryan gave me the name that I hold here tonight, Jennings Randolph. Let's see, in 1912, I shouldn't go back, but I want to tell you because something is proven. Woodrow Wilson was locked in a terrific fight with Champ Clark. William Jennings Bryan was the manager for Woodrow Wilson. He was then the governor of New Jersey. Any New Jersey people here that can come? Yes. William Jennings Bryan, back and forth between Seagirt, where the summer White House was, he carried the messages of the then governor of New Jersey. And then came the dramatic moment. William Jennings Bryan stood before the delegates and said, "I am commissioned by Woodrow Wilson to say that he will accept the nomination of the Democratic Party and carry the banner, hopefully, to victory, but there is one consideration that he must require." And the convention was quiet. He said he will not accept the nomination if the votes of Tammany Hall under Boss Murphy are necessary to nominate him. Do you realize that they're sitting in the convention where the delegates of Tammany Hall. So this was a bold statement to be made. I'll not go further in it except to say that Wilson was nominated and he did not have to have those votes to be the candidate or later the president of the United States. Now, in 1924, in your convention, you nominated a man to be a candidate for the chief executive position in this country, John W. Davis. He was graduated from Washington and Lee University. I take you back again for these scenes, and I may stop quicker than you think. My wife said to me one time after I'd spoken, I said, "Mary, how did I do tonight?" She said, "Very well, except you missed several opportunities to sit down." So I'm going to stay with you a little while, but not too long. But, John W. Davis, in that campaign, was not the leading contender. It was between Alfred E. Smith of New York and William McAdoo of California. They were locked in bitter voting. And then, after 103 ballots, you're not going to take that many here, after 103 ballots, the longest in the history of either party in its nominating process, John W. Davis, graduate of Washington Lee University, received the nomination. I don't want to have any trouble with the media, but at that time, radio was just coming in, no television. Bob Trout was the voice of radio. He said after the convention closed, within a few minutes, he said the Democrats, weary from 103 ballots, have gone home after nominating an obscure West Virginia lawyer, John W. Davis. Why, the very fact he was a graduate of Washington Lee University shouldn't make him obscure. No. But he'd been a member of the Congress. He'd been Solicitor General of the United States. He'd been our ambassador to the Court of St. James, the largest we have, of course, Great Britain. He was a man among men. But one of the tragedies of this country happened. John W. Davis lost to Calvin Coolidge. Think of it. Think of what happened. Think of it. Think of it. Think of it. Well, we, of course, in West Virginia, feel very kindly toward this university. Two of our governors in West Virginia were graduated from Washington Lee University. Two of them. I remember serving in the Senate at certain times with not just one, but two senators from the Commonwealth of Virginia who were born in West Virginia. You see, we didn't have any animosity, did we? No, we might have earlier, but not when we had Harry Byrd and Willis Robertson. They were your senators, both born in West Virginia, and your present governor. I think he's a very constructive young man. I really do. I think Rob will make good, not only as governor of the Commonwealth, but perhaps on a national scale. But his father was just born down the street from where I was born, in the state of West Virginia. And his parents, of course, live in West Virginia. And we are the only state, West Virginia, that was brought into being under the proclamation of a president of the United States. That was on June the 20th, 1863. We became a state, West Virginia, and that's all right. I feel good about it. His mother, Nancy Hanks, was born in West Virginia. I'm speaking for West Virginia tonight, in part. Now, yes, Stonewall Jackson. identified so very much with all of those of you, perhaps not understandably so. General McBee, when the Southern troops were being beaten back, he stood on his horse, not Lee, but McBee, and he said, "Look at Jackson. He stands like a stone wall." And I want you tonight to stand like a stone wall for the principles of the Democratic Party. That's what I'm asking you to do. That's what. Thank you. This Democratic Party has never strayed from its purpose, and that is that it's the party of what? Compassion. Yes, compassion. Absolutely. And it's the party, it may sound jingoistic, I don't care. It's the party of the people every time. I return to Franklin Roosevelt for just this moment. In 1936, when he sought renomination and election, this, my friends of this campus, I've taught in colleges and universities. I like your buoyancy, I like it. But just stay with me these few minutes as I talk to you about what Franklin Roosevelt said in 1936. Governments can err. Presidents do make mistakes. But the immortal Dante tells us that divine justice weighs the sins of the cold-blooded and the sins of the warm-hearted in different scales. Better, said Roosevelt, the occasional faults of a government that lives in a spirit of charity than the consistent omissions of a government frozen in the ice of its own indifference. Well, I'm talking about the Democratic Party as the party that has the catalyst of the people involved. That's what I'm talking, not, you know, talking at you, but asking you in the closing moments of tonight's session to just think of now what I'm going to say in these very, very few final discussions. It would have been easy for me tonight to tell you what ought to go in your platform. It would have been comparatively proper for me to say it's got to be this and it's got to be that. But I don't want to do that. I want you to, if you ever listen to a speaker, not because he's a member of the Congress, but someone who wants to help you, someone who understands what you can do in the tomorrows, just stay with me during these few minutes. What am I talking about? This is what I'm talking about. I was the author of the constitutional amendment for 18, 19, and 20-year-olds to vote. I stayed with it for 30 years before it came into being. In 1942, starting, Ellis Arnall, young, wonderful governor of Georgia. Why, that's the state that gave young people the first vote in this country, a southern state, really, Georgia. I went to Atlanta to see him. I said, I want a constitutional amendment so that young people throughout all the states will have not only the privilege but the responsibility of contributing to the voting process. Do you believe it's good? Well, he said yes, he believed it was good. That's enough to say. But then I had no interest whatsoever. The Judiciary Committee was there to hear my plea, but the Judiciary Committee wasn't there. Only one, the chairman, was there, and he wanted to get out quickly. I thought we'd have a room full of people, but only 11 men and women were there for a constitutional amendment that was to bring in the flow of the youth of this country in the process of using the ballot on Election Day. Now, why am I saddened tonight? You are not voting. You may not like to hear me say this, but you are not voting. I was up at Yale University, at a small school, of course. I was there speaking to the political union. I asked them to level with me. I said, will 100 of you stand who were eligible to vote in 1980? Would you stand, 100? I counted them, 100. I said, now, with all of what I am thinking, we come to the final test. Those that did not vote, will you please take your seats? How many remain standing? 19! 19 out of 100. That was the picture. Now, the young woman at Oklahoma City University, she waited afterward. She said, Mr. Randolph, I've listened to you tonight about voting, but I want you to tell me why, and she held up her finger, why my one vote is important. I said, it's important because it belongs to you. You can't transfer it. But listen now, as I say what I told her, but if you do not use it, that vote ceases to exist. It ceases to exist. Now listen. Of all the countries in the earth where people in varying degrees have the right and responsibility of the vote, the country of which you are the coming dynamic leadership, the United States of America. Where are we? Up at the top? Only one country has a worse record than us. That's Colombia in South America. We are next to the bottom in the participation of people who use their ballot on Election Day. Now, to go back to another Democratic president, I mentioned Franklin Roosevelt. Let's come to John Kennedy. He was elected in 1960, and 63 out of every 100 citizens eligible to vote cast their ballots. But 7 months after he was in office in 61, he commissioned a study to find why people did not vote. And then in making the announcement, he said, it is appalling, appalling, and he repeated it, the failure of the American people to use their ballot on Election Day. What happened? In that year, as I've indicated, 63 out of every 100. In 1980, think of this now, stay with me. Was it 63 out of every 100? It was 53 out of every 100 in this country. Now, this is what I'm fearful of. And you with the battalions to carry the ballots can change all of this around. You can do it. What can you do? It's a very simple task but a very compelling one. All right, let's see what you can do. You can do what has to be done, or we will, with 8 years from now, mark this all down, keep it in the record, we will elect a president of the United States by a minority of the voters rather than the majority of the voters in the United States of America. What do I mean? What do I mean? New York State here? Yes. Yeah. 1980? Yes. Only 48 out of every 100 eligible to vote in the Empire State were at the polls. Now, listen again with me. Listen again. What are we approaching? We're approaching the time when it will not be the majority winning over the minority. It will be, because we'll be voting less than 50%, it will be the majority of the minority over the rest of the minority. That's what's facing the United States of America. Are you going to do something about it? Are you? 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 Are you going to do something about it? Are you going to do it? Are you going to do it? Are you going to do it? Yes, sir, the flags are waving. The flags are waving. The flags are waving. Flags are waving. The flags are waving. Bring it up, bring it up. Vote, 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 vote,